This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
This is Linda Neville. My guests today are Ted Glenn, Joan Langmack, and Corliss Jacobs, representing Witness for Peace, speaking about their recent trip to Oaxaca, Mexico.
Corliss, you've made several excursions with Witness for Peace. Can you kind of give me an idea of what Witness for Peace is all about?
Witness for Peace is a politically independent, nationwide grassroots organization of people who are committed to nonviolent action on behalf of social and economic justice in Latin America. Its mission is to support peace, justice, and sustainable economies in the Americas by changing U.S. policies and corporate practices which contribute to poverty and oppression in those regions. Its purpose is to, first of all, educate people as to what is happening to common, ordinary people in our neighboring countries, and then people can be motivated to come back to the United States and share what they learned and educate others. It has mobilized and educated thousands of U.S. citizens over the last 30 years to speak out against our administration's policies and corporate practices that have had some really negative impacts on our southern neighbors.
Ted, can you give me some information when we're talking about NAFTA and what's going on there? And
most of your listeners probably know NAFTA as an acronym that stands for North American Free Trade Association. Last month in January, it celebrated its 20th anniversary. NAFTA was started with negotiations between Canada, the United States, and Mexico back during the George H.W. Bush administration and went into effect during the Bill Clinton administration. It has had bipartisan support. The goal was to reduce tariffs, which are taxes on imports and exports, so that trade could occur freely between the three countries. The promise to Mexico was that NAFTA would create a vibrant middle class, that it would create jobs, that the average pay would go up for the Mexican worker. The promise really hasn't been fulfilled for the average American worker. The poverty rate in Mexico today is the same as it was 20 years ago. Roughly 50% of all Mexicans live below the poverty line by their own government's definition. Over a million small farmers in Mexico have lost their jobs because they cannot compete with agriculture from the United States, which is subsidized by the American government. There are a lot of problems that have been created for average workers in Mexico. The same in the United States. We've seen over 500,000 manufacturing jobs in the United States lost during the 20 years of NAFTA. Now, there are many reasons for that besides NAFTA, I'm sure. But we've seen a stagnation in wages in the United States during the last 20 years. The basic lesson we learned about the effects of NAFTA on the economy of Mexico is that it's been great for the corporations, but it's not been so good for individual workers. But overall, the poverty rate in Mexico has not improved a whole lot since NAFTA went into effect 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I guess we don't know when we talk about poverty rate how desperate the poverty rate was and is.
Another thing about NAFTA is that the economic growth in Mexico has not been as good as in other Latin American countries in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about poverty, what did you see when it comes to the average in Oaxaca? That's where you visited. What are these people's lives like?
Oaxaca is known as a tourist destination. It's both a city and a state. I think you may have mentioned that. That's the name of like New York City and New York State. It's the same as that naming. The city itself is filled with beautiful colonial architecture. It's got great hotels for people to maybe in luxury or other levels. And it's surrounded by mountains, plateaus, beaches, forests. It's a traveler's paradise, actually. Lots of people come. It's known for its traditional crafts, which are mostly created by rural villages in home workshops by indigenous people. The interesting thing about Oaxaca is that there are at least 16 different indigenous populations there. Indigenous meaning original people, people whose cultures were established long before the Spanish even came. These people are trying to maintain their culture, their artwork, and their heritage, and that mixing in with the whole of Oaxaca has made it a really interesting place for people to visit.
So, yeah, so we have like the tourist Oaxaca that you see, and it's so colorful and beautiful. But then there really are two Oaxacas. The other Oaxaca is one where people are earning a basic daily wage of $1 to $5 a day. They are living in nutritional poverty. They have basic services are inadequate for health, for education. They are concerned about the erosion of the land. There are just many, many problems that basically you don't see unless you look. And that's basically what we did in Witness for Peace, is that we were able to go around, talk to several non-governmental agencies that are trying to help the people to maintain a life that is sustainable, that's nutritionally sound. One of the places that I went to is called Campo, and the purpose of Campo was basically to provide people with a way of having a sustainable life so that they don't have to leave the area. It's based on things that they traditionally know, their way of farming. But there are lots of other problems, such as the water pollution. So they need to have a method of getting potable water, water that's drinkable, to take care of waste products. And there are ways of doing this and at an affordable price of having enough food to eat by growing food locally, so they have programs. Anyway, it's just an incredible project where local professionals, people that live in Oaxaca, maybe have been educated and then returned to Oaxaca, engineers, veterinarians, lawyers, anthropologists, have all gathered together to create programs to basically make a life which is good and also enriched.
So is the government playing a role in this at all?
I think there's minimal help from the government, but most basically these are non-governmental agencies. And they are statewide. One of the things that they do, for example, is to work with solar energy to create ways of dealing with waste products, sewage, natural fertilization, to find ways of using the things that are indigenous to the area and that are safe for the environment, maintaining forest in a responsible way, maintaining the water, making sure the water is clean. Just providing for what we all want, a sustainable life that's, you know, that we can enjoy without living in a state of poverty. And these organizations are incredible because they are primarily an advisory, that the people want to have this information. They want to be able to stay in their villages. They want their communal life. And they actually seek out the help of the people. It's not as if these organizations are going out beating the bushes trying to get people to, you know, go with their way of life. That they function in an advisory capacity, and they are all over the state of Oaxaca. Oaxaca being one of the second poorest states in Mexico, Chiapas being the other one, and primarily populated by indigenous population.
I think it's really interesting that the organizations you're talking about, I think, if I remember, almost all the leaders and people who were working as professionals in those organizations were indigenous people.
Right.
And I was totally amazed at the value that the indigenous communities we met placed on education, and also the wisdom that they have had from years of cultivating crops in a certain way. They have for centuries cultivated crops in sustainable ways.
Right.
And I thought that was absolutely amazing, because that doesn't fit with the image that a lot of people here in the U.S. have of Mexican people who end up having to cross the border to try to find a job.
Did you have figures, Ted, about what percentage of corn in Mexico used to be produced
in Mexico versus what percentage is produced now in Mexico after NAFTA? It dropped precipitously. Just
basically, in the area where we were, the farmers have small plots of land that they plant corn on, and they simply cannot compete with large industrial farms in the United States, which are subsidized by the American government. Mm-hmm. And by Mexico's own statistics, over 1 million farmers have lost their jobs in the last 20 years since NAFTA started, simply because the free trade is not really free when one government is subsidizing agriculture and another government isn't. So if you lose your job farming, you have to find something to do. You either immigrate to Mexico City, or you...
Which is high crime.
Or you cross the border into the States. You have to find some way to make a living. So that was one of the themes that we heard over and over again, is that a lot of the immigration is really due to the corporate policies that have been, in a sense, put into effect by this free trade agreement, NAFTA.
Become aware that a lot of times people cross the border and end up working for some of the very corporations that push them out of business in Mexico, because after NAFTA, corporations were able to, of course, go south, cross the border, get cheaper labor, and in doing so maintain corporations then on this side of the border, and that a lot of times people who then made it across because they couldn't make a living in Mexico anymore ended up working in a slaughterhouse or on an agri farm, picking things that may be connected to the very corporation that put them out of business there. It's just a sad irony.
Where's the GMO? What is that doing? The sustainability of the food. I think we've briefly touched on that, but do you have anything else to say when it comes to that issue?
When we went out to a couple of villages, actually, farmers were telling us how they had discovered about 10 years ago, I think, that their crops they were strange. Their crops didn't look the same. And after having testing done and doing research, they discovered that there had been a corn crop planted a distance away that was GMO corn from Monsanto, and that had the pollination, as it does here often, went across the valley and the boundaries into their corn crop, and it affected their corn. Now, some people might think, well, that's no big deal, it's just corn. But the Mexico indigenous people, they're actually the ones who developed corn thousands of years ago. And over a time, they ended up with something like 80 different varieties of corn.
I know.
It's amazing. And we learned that the corn that is native corn is actually more nutritious. And when tortillas and drinks and other things are made from that, there's a lot more nutrition in that than the corn that we have here in the U.S. now, since 90% of our corn is, approximately 90% is GMO corn. And apparently that whole process has removed a lot of the nutrition. Our corn is, a lot of it goes for biofuel, most of it goes for animal feed. I mean, we don't eat corn other than sweet corn here. Also, of course, high fructose corn syrup is the huge thing, and it all then can be made very cheap, particularly nutritious, at all. And so now when Mexican people are having to buy U.S. GMO corn, then the nutrition level of that is much lower.
And obesity, that the corn is sort of like wheat is in our country. It's the meal, it's the bread. In a way, it's like not only are they contaminating the nutritional value, but they're also contaminating kind of the heritage, the life source of a country. I think Mexico now only grows 40% of their own corn.
Right,
it's
one of the ironies that Mexico is the source of the original corn agriculture, and yet now they import over half of their corn.
Well, the thing I learned about that too that I hadn't really thought about is that when a country or a people become so reliant on importing their food. When the world market prices go up, they're faced with, and perhaps their economy and their earning power has not gone up with those world market prices, then they're faced with a food shortage because they can't afford to buy the food that is being imported into their country. Shortly after NAFTA, world prices did go up on corn. And one thing that we learned is that, I mean, when I've been in Mexico in the past, I've always thought, well, you know, this is a great place to be a traveler because the prices are much less than prices here, and so then it, you know, feels good. But we all commented on that it seemed as if the prices of things that we were buying or food that we were buying wasn't that much different than it is here. That's a powerful statement when we realize how low the income is. Many people who have been pressured downward, and we did read that inflation has gone up significantly in Mexico since NAFTA, but the average wage and income has gone down. I guess that sounds a little bit like what's happening in the U.S. too.
Does sound familiar.
That income disparity problem.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is what each one of you came back individually that you felt was the most important thing, the highest point, maybe the most personal incident that occurred to you. Did you have something that was on an emotional level? Was it just information?
I dream about this town up in the Sierra Mountains. It's titled Kapalapam. Hard for me to say. It was a Zapotec town, and a lot of, by the way, the people who are indigenous still speak their traditional languages. They pretty much all speak Spanish, except sometimes some of the very older people, we were told, didn't even speak Spanish because they had their traditional language that they had kept. Most of the kids are bilingual, I think, that are educated in the villages, in the village schools. But this town was about 7,000 feet up in the mountains. It was cold at night. That's not what you expect for some reason. When you go to Mexico, you think it's all going to be warm. And the community was absolutely amazing. They had faced all kinds of problems before and after NAFTA. But especially after NAFTA, a mining corporation, there had been a mine near the town for 100 years and it had finally been closed. And that old mine had poisoned their water and done a lot of bad stuff to the environment. You know, when you mine gold, you use arsenic and cyanide. And so when that goes into the water, that's a pretty horrible thing. But anyway, the mine finally closed because whatever corporation had it thought that they were done. There was no more gold there to be had at a decent price. Well, now the price of gold has gone up. New technology has made it profitable to reopen old mines, and so a corporation from Canada wanted to reopen the mine, and people knew what that would do. A logging company had been in there on their land for years. There had been some sort of government grant given to that logging company, and they had totally clear cut the mountainsides, so they were bare, obviously erosion. And now a new mining company or a new logging company wanted to come in. The people didn't want that either. I am not clear on how they were able to do this, but the community stood up all together. They had a plan. They were amazing people, well-educated. They were able to keep the corporations out. They were able to keep the mine closed. They have their own logging business now, which they do in a sustainable way. They have planted from seedlings that they started themselves 1 million trees to reforest their hillsides. They also, they used to have about 13 aquifers, but the old mine ruined some of those. And now they at least have one spring that's pure, so they bottle water. The community was just beautiful up there in the mountains, and they're working on it to make it a tourist attraction also, which will be helpful. And they had some eco lodges, which they had built, that we loved. That's my memory. It gave me hope. It showed me that grassroots is where things will change, both in their country and ours, and that how we have to stand together to make it happen.
Excellent. Ted?
For me, the most interesting part of our delegation spent approximately a day and a half with families. There were only four men in our delegation, so we all went to one family. The family was headed by a man named Andreas, who spoke fluent English because he had lived the first 21 years of his life in Los Angeles. As an infant, his father had crossed the border illegally to find work. Andreas grew up in Los Angeles. He went to school there, all the way through junior college. He worked in the United States. Then he got word at about age 21 that his grandmother was ill. He decided to go back to Mexico to visit her, and he took medicine with him that she needed. He was stopped at the border. When they found the medicine, they revoked his green card. He was told he should never cross the border again or he would be arrested. So he now lives in Oaxaca. He knows three languages, Spanish, English, and Zatapec, which is one of the indigenous languages. He does all sorts of things. He works as a farmer. He grows corn. He has milk cows. He also works as a translator for tourists. He does everything he can to earn a living for his family. He has a wife, his mother-in-law, he has three children. And it's just amazing family to get to know. We share meals with them. We share conversation with them. We got to see how they live their daily life. And it was just purely wonderful. Andres told us that if you earn $1,000 a month in Oaxaca, you're rich. He said, I'm not there yet. And he wasn't bitter. But we could tell that his family had something that a lot of Americans who earn a lot more than $1,000 a month don't have, which they had a sense of solidarity, and they shared with us.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Jonas, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I just have to reiterate just how impressed I was with the organizations that were working in the communities to help them and to basically advise them when they wanted it, how to maintain their communities, that these are their own people. They're not like outsiders coming in and telling them what to do,
mm-hmm.
that it's a grassroots organizations, and that they just the skills that they have are just overwhelming. And in fact, you know, there's the sorts of things that we can learn from them. And I suppose that the overwhelming thing I learned or realized is just how connected we all are, that we're really facing exactly the same problems. We may have different cultures. We may have, you know, maybe a different way of living our daily lives. But in fact, we're all concerned about the water safety, the food safety, taking care of our waste products, making sure that the land is sustainable, and the things that are affecting the people in Oaxaca are the same things that are affecting us in our world today, and I'm sure globally. It seems as if the corporations have realized how globally connected we are, and they've taken a great advantage of that. They've used it for their own, unfortunately, they've used it for their own wealth and greed. And I think it's time for us maybe to wake up and realize we do have a global community, and we need to use that information to maintain and to enrich ourselves, making a sustainable world.
We're all in this together. I think we need to realize against the powers that don't seem to be interested in anything beyond profit. This experience made me really question our view of development and growth. What is that, and why is that so much more important than sustainability and maintenance of a quality life? And solidarity of the people. Witness for Peace is a solidarity organization. That's what it is. It doesn't give charity. It doesn't go and build churches for somebody or anything of that, or even give money to people. It works to create those bonds and then help us all realize that we are in this together, and we've got to work hard together to change policies. If anybody wants to know more about Witness for Peace, you can find it online at www.witnessforpeace.org.
I have to thank you all. You made some interesting, very insightful points.
You've been listening to an interview of three members of Witness for Peace, Corliss Jacobs, Joan Langmack, and Ted Glenn, speaking about their recent trip to Oaxaca, Mexico. This is Linda Neville, and I thank you for listening.
This is Dave Mitchell with Global Warming Corner. Global warming is a reality. In May 2010, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences produced 5 studies on climate change. One of these studies, Advancing the Science of Climate Change, concluded, climate change is happening. Human activities are largely responsible, and these conclusions are, quote, based on a strong, credible body of evidence. Also, climate change, quote, poses a significant risk for, and in many cases is already affecting, a broad range of human and natural systems. How did it come to this? Beginning with the Industrial Revolution about 1750, humanity has been pumping ever-increasing amounts of fossil fuel pollutants into our atmosphere. In May 2013, National Geographic reported the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii measuring 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. It has been 3 million years since CO2 was that high, with horses and camels living in the high Arctic. Average temperatures were only 3.6 to 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than now. In their online site on climate change, the Environmental Protection Agency reports Earth has warmed 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 100 years. Projections indicate a range of 2 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit additional increase in the next 100 years. Anything even approaching 11 degrees Fahrenheit additional warming would be a nightmare world with a major collapse of our biosphere. With 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit warming, what has the U.S. experienced so far? A partial list from the Environmental Protection Agency includes the U.S. North, West, and Alaska have had the most warming. Since the 1970s, unusually hot summers are more common, heat waves are more frequent, and since 1990, 8 of the top 10 years for extreme one-day precipitation events has occurred. Precipitation has increased 5% in the last 100 years, with the last 50 years wetter than average. However, the year 2000 to 2012 has seen 30 to 70% of the U.S. in drought conditions at any given time. The last 20 years has seen an increase in tropical cyclones due to warmer waters in the tropical Atlantic. Let us not forget 2012, the warmest year on record for the lower 48. Major drought conditions existed over much of the country with a multitude of wildfires, the loss of 60% of our corn crop. Currently, California has been suffering a terrible drought all of 2013. NBC Bay Area News reported on January 28, 2014, Governor Brown declared a drought emergency for the state. He declared the drought threatens the state with dramatically less water for farms and communities, as well as increased wildfires. The state water project will honor only 5% of requested water deliveries. The state snowpack is only 20% of normal. There could be a devastating impact on California's Central Valley, a significant source of fruits and vegetables for the nation. Let us look north to Alaska. They had been suffering a heat wave the last 2 weeks of January 2014, one of the warmest winter periods in their history, with temperatures as far as 40 degrees Fahrenheit above normal in the central and western parts. On mangabay.com, they cite the Environmental Protection Agency indicating the average temperatures in Alaska have risen 3.4 degrees Fahrenheit over the last 50 years due to, you guessed it, global warming. So, to sum all this up, it's getting hotter, folks, and things aren't pretty in the long term. To avoid the nightmare scenario of approaching 11 degrees Fahrenheit additional warming in the next century, humanity must engage in a transformative process to a truly sustainable global society which lives within the limits of the Earth. Until next time, this is Dave Mitchell with KKFI's Global Warming Corner.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.